The Tom Woods Show, episode 719.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're looking for more libertarian podcasts, check out the Jason Stapleton program, hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. Monday through Friday, get a libertarian take on the news. Check it out at jasonstapleton.com. If you're a homeschooling parent and you're tired of running yourself ragged, then check out the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. And check it out through my special link where you get three free bonuses totaling $160. My special link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here, talking about the FBI today with Ryan McMakin, who joins us once again. Ryan is the economics editor and communications director at the Mises Institute, which, of course, you can visit at mises.org. And we'll probably also talk a little bit about policing in general. I've got several articles of Ryan's linked on the show notes page today, tomwoods.com/719. Now, after my conversation with Ryan, I have an announcement I want to make, and I'm going to be making this announcement on several episodes because I think that's the easiest way to track down all the people who will find this announcement helpful. So stay tuned for the mystery announcement after my discussion with Ryan. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
All right. So you got an article on getting rid of the FBI. Now, that is just crazy, crazy libertarian talk, my friend. That just don't make no sense. It's called Abolish the FBI. The FBI is there to solve crimes, you know, to solve crimes that involve people going from one state to another. Kidnappers crossing state lines, bank robbers running away, whatever it is. You need the FBI. That just seems like a crazy thing to say. Now, if I just turn it to you and say, why should we abolish the FBI? Your answer will be the whole episode, and that's not good interviewing technique. So let's start with this. What was the occasion for your thought to write an article on abolishing the FBI? What's going on today that makes you think there's something wrong with the FBI?
Well, the event that precipitated the article was the FBI's decision to not indict Hillary for anything, not so much as even a misdemeanor. And so, and then they turn around, James Comey turns around and says, oh, well, she did all these awful things, but we decided there wasn't enough evidence to indict, and no reasonable prosecutor would even indict in a case like this. Basically saying that anyone who does decide to go ahead and try to indict her is an unreasonable, crazy person. And so you're thinking about the way the FBI treats normal people, people not named Clinton, or Bush, or haven't been in the White House, or don't have some special privileged status in society, then of course the FBI treats those people completely differently. They will come up with any number of things that they can use from federal law to lock you away for decades if necessary, even if it's some trifling little totally non-violent drug offense or something like that, or some totally made-up thing under the RICO Act where you bought and sold some stocks and they look into that and they find some pattern that shows you were involved in some sort of shady scam. And the next thing you know, you're spending hundreds of thousands on legal defense and then you're in prison. So apparently you get different treatment if you're special. And so I thought, well, you know, what's with this FBI? Let's look a little bit more closely at this organization, which is clearly a political organization. But the FBI kind of benefits, I think, from the same thing the Supreme Court does, is Americans believe this silliness about how, well, since the director of the FBI is appointed and not elected, they must be this good, non-political, conscientious organization. They must just always be doing – they do what's right. And that, of course, is complete nonsense.
All right. What are the origins of the FBI then? I think a lot of people would assume that it came about because there was a gap in existing law enforcement, that people at the local level couldn't cope with crimes that went way, way beyond their jurisdiction. So in order to help coordinate among law enforcement agencies or to have an umbrella organization, we had the FBI, and this solved that problem. What's wrong with that? Is that a romantic pie in the sky view of where the FBI came from?
Well, that's certainly what the FBI said. To more discriminating consumers. In fact, as I was writing this, I was thinking about a discussion that Paul Cantor had of the FBI in his old book, Gilligan Unbound, where he talks about the X-Files. And in it, it contains a discussion of the FBI, specifically a 1959 movie called The FBI Story, which is kind of the gold standard of pro FBI movies from that post-war period when everybody was worshiping all these federal institutions. And there's a discussion in it where the topic of why do we need the FBI comes up. And Cantor notes that the entire discussion then is just laid to rest with this sentence: the country's growing and crime will grow with it. That's it. And then, for the rest of the movie, we don't have to worry about whether we need an FBI anymore. That's all. So it's comically simplistic in what is really presented to the general public. But of course, if you start asking questions and so on, the FBI will say, yes, there were bank robberies. And what if they went to a neighboring state? Or what if they kidnapped someone and took them to a neighboring state and all that sort of thing? Of course, what they don't point out is that doesn't require this unified organization with agents and all of that. It's not like in Europe, I kidnap somebody in France and I go next door to Luxembourg or something. Oh, well, I guess I got away with it because now I'm beyond the French border. So no problem now. That's, you know, states can work together. Organizations can work together. So if the FBI had to exist, it should have no function other than helping state police organizations simply share information and such. There is no need for this huge army of FBI agents to run around enforcing the 10,000 federal laws that have been written in the meantime.
Well, in fact, you even, I guess it's the Q&A over at the FBI's website, you reproduce the following Q and their A, which is the FBI a type of national police force? And the current answer is no. The FBI is a national security organization that works closely with many partners around the country and across the globe, to address the most serious security threats facing the nation. So these ain't kidnapping cases.
Yeah, they used to say they were a crime organization, like in the FBI story. But in recent years, they suddenly decided, oh, we're national security now. Maybe they decided that's more lucrative when it comes to lobbying Congress. But yeah, no more talk about kidnapping and chasing people across state lines now, unless they're terrorists. I guess it's just more prestigious than to send agents to Kazakhstan or whatever to track down terrorists. I thought we had, you know, national security organizations in the Department of Defense and such, but apparently not. Apparently they're all in the Department of Justice, and we need the FBI now to chase Al-Qaeda.
I'm going to, obviously, of course, we're linking to your article at tomwoods.com/719. I like the section on the FBI being created to compete with private agencies. And I like that in particular, first of all, because that's probably not what people think, but I like it for several reasons. One of them is the idea that at that time, public government-run police had a terrible reputation, and people don't realize that. Throughout the 19th century, they had a terrible reputation for corruption. So that's worth knowing. That's the point that you make in that section. Secondly, you mentioned the Pinkerton Detective Agency, which in the American history textbook in every single American history class across the country is demonized for being terrible, and they were strike breakers and so on and on. But the only reason the Pinkertons existed was that the actual so-called police weren't doing anything when workers would – some workers, union workers, would go and commit violence against non-union workers or destroy property or whatever. The police that the company was paying taxes for would just stand there. And so, yeah, somebody's got to protect property rights. And, yeah, I know that's not what you learned in school, but – and I know that I'm sure there are some left libertarians who will hate the fact that I said this, that I'm supposed to stand with the oppressed workers or whatever. But no, if you're beating somebody to death with brick bats, I'm not standing with you. No.
Well, yes, let's be fair to the pro-FBI arguers, I suppose. The argument is that local police, they're basically servants of the local machine. So, you know, they kind of do the personal bidding of the mayor of Philadelphia or whatever. And they don't have a life outside of doing what helps the local Democratic Party machine or Republican Party machine. And they also, since these cops lived among the general population, they were unwilling to enforce the law because that might make them unpopular with the local population and such. And so the idea was, okay, we're going to create this hyper-professional federal force, and they're not going to be beholden to any local politics, and they'll just be people like Elliot Ness, and they will just do their job properly, and politics will not affect them in any way. But of course, what happens then is, okay, we've created this agency that's totally separate from local politics, but now all this means is that it's at the beck and call of federal politicians now, and totally untouchable from any local interests. So you can just send them into local communities and they can do whatever they want, and just screw you if you're a local person who doesn't like the FBI. We now have this federal police force that's beyond anything that you can do. So it is above politics, but that just means that now they can do what they want, and you can't vote them out of office. You can't get to them in any way as a normal person. But yeah, as you noted, of course, if you went through a college program like I did, where you were taught by a bunch of leftists, and these leftists I happen to like, they were conscientious people and so on, but deeply ingrained in the general view of the Pinkertons and private law enforcement in this period was that, yeah, they were strike breakers. They were servants of this evil capitalist class. And so, of course, we had to create something like the FBI apart from the private detective agencies. And that, when we start to look at, especially in this article titled appropriately, The Forgotten Threat, Private Policing in the State, which I link to in this article. It's by a woman named Elizabeth Joe. She talks about how these private police forces function. Now, of course, when I'm reading, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, that sounds pretty good. I'm pretty impressed with how these private police forces.
Yeah, that was probably not the intention of the article.
No, she, of course, her slant was the opposite. She wanted me to think exactly the opposite, pointing out all these things they did, all this strike breaking and so on. Now she admits begrudgingly that, oh, yeah, they did really fight crime much better than the private police forces, but they spent so much of their time strike breaking that obviously we had to get rid of them. So when we look at it, we find that the FBI really is a product of left-wing pro-labor politics. That was the impetus behind getting rid of groups like the Pinkertons.
All right, I'm looking, let's see. I want to read actually a little passage from your article here, talking again about the Pinkertons. The Pinkertons were primarily interested in property crime with actual victims, i.e. train robbing. The FBI, however, could be used to go after political enemies, protesters, supposed draft dodgers, and others who ran afoul of government regulations created to benefit the government itself. And that you say over time the FBI would crowd out the Pinkertons as a national police force. This was all to the good, according to many critics of the Pinkertons, who wanted a government-controlled national police force that could be used against the private sector rather than be controlled by it. All right, you've got a section, the FBI is a product of anti-capitalist movements. Boy, this article just has it all. We'll get to that after we thank our sponsor. Folks, I know there's a major pain point in your life, and that pain point comes when you look at your device and you are out of Tom Woods Show episodes. What to do other than despair? Well, how about checking out the Jason Stapleton program? Monday through Friday, Jason gives you a libertarian overview of the news. A lot of people are on me to do more current events. That's what Jason does every single day for an hour. So you get current events, economics, and politics from a libertarian perspective. The Jason Stapleton program is one of the fastest growing libertarian podcasts in the world with over 20,000 daily listeners. Download the show today on iTunes or Stitcher or your favorite podcasting app, or visit jasonstapleton.com to find out more. Jason says give him 10 episodes and he'll make you a more informed libertarian. Take that challenge at jasonstapleton.com. Jason's a friend and a booster of my show, so check him out at jasonstapleton.com. All right, in that section that I was just talking about, you have a brief mention of the Homestead strike and what happened there. And that story, I think, has been totally distorted. I must have an episode where I talk about what really happened there. If I don't, well, you know what I'll do? You know what I'll do? At tomwoods.com/719, I will link to the great Charles Baird article that goes through several of the major labor episodes in late 19th century America. And what he does is he just goes back to the primary sources, and he goes back to the newspaper accounts, like the New York Times own accounts of what was happening. And he says, if I do that, I get a much clearer understanding of what happened than if I look at any history textbook there is, which is always trying to cheer on one particular side. So I'll link to that. But this is one of these things that helped to damage the reputation of the Pinkertons in the public mind, even though the Pinkerton detectives were being shot at and they were sitting on a barge where the union workers were trying to blast them with dynamite. I mean, it seems a little bit reversed to have them be the bad guys in that particular situation. But you say that the Pinkertons never functioned with despite all the demonization of them, they never functioned with the sort of firepower, manpower, and legal immunity enjoyed by federal agencies today. And you say, in some cases, the Pinkertons surrendered to their so-called victims, as in the case of Homestead, where, outnumbered, the Pinkerton guards surrendered and were beaten by an angry mob. So, you know, so much for the totally invincible private sector police that we're supposed to be so scared of.
Well, part of the problem that the Pinkertons had, from their perspective, was that the courts were often very suspicious of them. That since the private detective agencies aren't part of the government, they didn't benefit from their kind of in relationship with the government the way that the FBI does and the way that modern police organizations do. So there was actually a seen disconnect between the courts. Judges saw themselves as sometimes adversaries of these private organizations. So if you were the Pinkertons, you just simply couldn't rush into this group of people, claim officer safety is paramount, and just start shooting people. And because once you were brought to court, then later, how did you conduct yourself in this strike-breaking operation? If you shot a bunch of people, you might find yourself in jail. There wasn't any of this sovereign immunity stuff that modern police can claim. And so that's actually a great thing about private police, is you're on much more even ground when dealing with them once you end up in court. And so you would want a separate policing organization. You don't want somebody who basically has lunch with the judge all day long as the prosecutor or as the head of the FBI or whatever. And if you look then at some of these accounts, you're often struck by how low the body counts are, if you will. I mean, in most cases, nobody's killed. There's beatings, and usually the fatality rates are 2-3 people. And I remember being told so much of my life. Now, the Pinkertons weren't directly involved in the Ludlow Massacre, but here in Colorado, the Ludlow Massacre is this big, big deal. They sent in the National Guard. It was a big strike-breaking operation. But that's all kind of mixed up together with these private organizations. You're supposed to believe that the Pinkertons were part of it and so on. But the body count from that was very, very low. It was tiny compared to something like Waco. And, of course, it's the Waco siege. Nobody calls it the Waco massacre because I guess the FBI was in charge of that massacre. So if private capitalists are involved, it's a massacre. If the FBI kills 80 people, then it's just a siege, I suppose.
It's a siege. Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. All right. You know, I realize that you have done a series of articles relating to the general subject of policing, which is obviously relevant to this discussion. So I do want to ask you a little bit about that, if I may. You are, at one point, you're looking at the question of why it seems to be the case that more often than you would expect, police encounters seem to escalate from something more or less mundane to, in some cases, something quite terrible. And you're trying to get to the bottom of why that is. And what do you think at least part of the answer is?
Well, the FBI is an example of this. It was created in this period of the early 20th century where the feds started passing drug laws and a lot of federal statutes about peaceful activities like creating drugs or selling drugs, as well as other business-related type of activities that nobody would have identified as a crime in the 19th century. Most people thought of crime as violent crime. But this was a period then that we're going to assign the FBI or other federal agencies to finding who's making bathtub gin, and we're going to track these people down. And then there's gun runners. We got to track them down. So all of a sudden now in the 20th century, government's in the business of searching people. Where simply possessing things are a crime, whereas in the past you had to actually do criminal things. You couldn't just simply possess certain objects and be considered a criminal. And so you can imagine then now in modern times, this applies to both federal and local police now. If you're in a situation where the police see it as their duty to search people and to constantly control what it is that people own, what it is that people sell, then their whole relationship with you is different now. Okay, I pulled somebody over for speeding or whatever. In a more sane world, they would simply issue your citation and let you go, unless they had reason to believe that you had just robbed a bank or something like that. However, now every traffic stop, every encounter is an opportunity to see, well, maybe this person has some drugs on them. Maybe this person has an illegal gun in the back of the car. So they start questioning you. They act like they're your friend. Let's casually see if they're in possession of something that I should be taking away and so on. So now every interaction with the police is an opportunity for the situation to escalate to a situation where you might be serving decades in jail or in prison. Whether state or federal. And so this makes people, of course, very touchy, more likely to actually act out. And in a lot of cases, sure, yeah, these people do have drugs on them because they're drug addicts and so on. Whereas in the past, that thing would have simply been ignored. People would have been cited for actually violent or antisocial behavior. But those days are gone now, and now it's the police's job to regulate many aspects of your life and to engage in regular searches. So it's you've just set up everything to escalate to a violent situation. And that's part of the reason that we see so many of these things in the news where, well, they pulled over some guy and the next thing you know, shooting breaks out, or the cops are all paranoid and they open fire. They wanted to search. This created bad blood and so on. There's really no need for that. But that's where we've come in the last several decades.
There's also the social phenomenon that you talk about, whereby in the same way that the general public has been conditioned to expect the U.S. president to have an opinion on every subject, to involve himself in the smallest matters of civil society, likewise, there's at least a segment of the population that looks to the police to a degree that is unreasonable. You know, where you gave the example of a mom whose son is playing video games too often, so she calls the police. And this is exactly the wrong way to go about things. I know people who say never ever call the police, but certainly if you're going to call the police, it should absolutely be a last resort when there's absolutely nothing else you can do. But we've gotten this superstitious view that the police are necessary to solve all kinds of problems.
Well, and of course, in the article, I note a couple of extreme examples, and these show up often on the Drudge Report. Yeah, so like it's the outrage of the day sort of article, right? Woman calls police because Burger King got her order wrong and things like that. Now, you know, we laugh at those things, how silly and so on. But of course, people call the police all the time because they have like a disagreeable family member. Or there's something happening totally on private property that you wouldn't even classify as violent. But we want the police to show up and solve the problem for us. Someone won't take their meds, for example, or I can't convince this guy to go to the hospital. These things often end in shootings and other unpleasant things that occur, escalations and such. And why is the police's job to show up and have somebody get to the hospital and so on? This person's an adult. It's up to them whether they take their meds and so on. And part of the reason is simple economics is, oh, I've got a problem. I can call 911 and people will show up for free and they'll basically do arbitration, if you will. Now, of course, they're not trained to do that, but they show up, you know, they'll help my mentally ill brother take his meds or whatever. And guess what? It doesn't cost me a dime. So every time there's some sort of unpleasantness happening, well, I'll just call the police. And then this, of course, bleeds into more institutional situations as well, where you've got places like movie theaters or private gated communities and so on. These places should be in charge of their own private security. But since it's all state subsidized and you can call the police to come in, show up for free and do all that for you, now people are like, well, why should I do private security? I can just have the police show up and solve all these little problems from A to Z. And what we have found now is that people have adopted this idea that, oh, well, this is a job for the police. I'm on this totally private installation. I'm in a private country club or so on. There should be private security in this place, but nope. We'll just sit around, wait for something bad to happen, and then we'll call the police and they show up. So it socializes the costs of police services. It encourages people not to plan ahead for their own needs or to develop organizations and social networks that might help them solve some of these social problems. Just simply call the police. They'll show up, and then when they're done, you won't get a bill for it. Imagine if it was the same way for calling an ambulance. Where, oh well, I've got a minor pain. I cut my foot. So just call an ambulance and they'll take me to the emergency room. Now, of course, you do that now, you get a huge bill for a couple grand or something, as it should be when you could have just driven yourself to the emergency room. And so treating the police a little bit differently in that regard might go a long way toward reducing costs and reducing reliance on the police.
Well, I'll tell you, I did an episode at this point quite a while ago with Bruce Benson on the subject of private police. So I'm going to link to that also at tomwoods.com/719 along with your articles, because of course people might genuinely want to know what would that look like and how would that work, and that's a whole separate question. And of course it's a question that most free market people don't raise, because respectable free market people, and I'm not saying this to be to taunt them or anything, because I was one too, it just never dawns on them that the same economic principles they apply to the supply of any other good or service, they can't or won't imagine them applied to the production of security. But security is also, it's an economic good. We have scarce resources, and of course we all want security, but manpower that's devoted to security, it has to be withdrawn from something else. So we have competing ends, and there has to be some way to decide how these labor services ought to be allocated, and we haven't come up with a better system than the system of economic calculation on the market. So it's not so crazy after all. And of course, libertarians like to point out that when you're at Disney World, you don't feel unsafe, even though there are no public police anywhere to be found. And generally, you don't even see any private security. It's yet you know they've got a handle on that situation, that somehow they know what they're doing, and they do it without a guy walking down the street with an Uzi or something. They've figured out a way to provide security in an unobtrusive way that makes people feel comfortable over a very, very large area. So sometimes it's useful to think this way and to think in just creative ways about things that we've up to now thought quite conventionally about.
Yeah, well, we certainly don't want to be those libertarians who say, well, if you just get rid of the police, everybody will get along. I mean, certainly we don't think that's true.
You gotta have some kind of security, right?
Right, and private security has been effective and used in the past, as noted in all of this research on the Pinkertons. You don't need the FBI to, for example, provide security for trains, even though they go from state to state and grow across the country. And they weren't the only private organization. There were tons of them. And these people, it was regarded at the time, if you needed investigative services of some kind, you paid for one of these private organizations to do it. Now, you could argue, oh, well, what about poor people? And do they get any services and so on? That doesn't necessarily mean you need a huge federal agency now to address that issue. That can be addressed in other ways, as Benson and others have addressed in their own writing. So there are market strategies here. And I don't even take a particularly radical view. I just simply note some ways that you can chip away at eliminating the government monopoly on police. You can simply make more room for private security in these cases, which is what we find happening right now anyway. There's just as in the 19th century, when there was declining faith in local police to provide services, people turned to private security to fill in the gap. And they did that quite effectively. And they didn't ban the use of public police. They just simply did not have an over-reliance on it and recognized its shortcomings. And people are doing that now, although it's not, of course, reported or lauded in any ways, that people are turning more toward private security. The numbers of private security personnel have been going up significantly. And so, yes, there's very much a role for that there. And once we start to look into policing, though, we find that it's just amazing how much people rely on policing, how inappropriate it is a lot of the time. If you need someone to show up and you've got a homeless guy who just kind of passed out in your yard, or he kind of set up shop next to you, you don't necessarily need heavily armed guys with guns to show up and escalate that situation immediately. There are many other ways of addressing that situation. Now, if the guy turns violent, then yes, maybe you would need policing, but that is often not what happens. There's no violence that ensues in those situations. However, we've set up administratively, the way the government works is the first line of contact with the state for many of these people is with armed police. And I think experience has shown that's not necessarily the best way of going about things.
Well, I'm going to link to your stuff again at tomwoods.com/719. And I got to keep a closer eye on what you're writing because it always makes for juicy episodes. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you very much.
All right. Now for the mystery announcement. Well, I'm going to make you wait 1 second for the mystery announcement because I want to tell you about yet another. Can you believe I got people starting websites all over the place here? And this is another Tom Woods Show listener who started a website. It's called The Chosen Weeds, thechosenweeds.com. And the tagline is ideas and principles rooted in sustainability, health, and personal liberty. In the About section, we read this site is dedicated to the ideas, principles, and practice that cultivate a deeper sense of wholeness, confidence, self-reliance, and individual liberty. Categories include education, health, homesteading, product reviews, and recipes, and lots of interesting posts on a variety of topics. So very much worth checking out, thechosenweeds.com, linked at tomwoods.com/719. I give this shout out because this person went to tomwoods.com/publicity before starting the site. And if you do what's asked for there, it's very simple. You get a shout out, a backlink, and a bunch of tutorials to help you out. All right. Well, anyway, here's the big announcement. Somebody came up with a really, really good idea, which is what if we had a, you know, I have a private Facebook group for my supporters and we chit chat and, you know, plot over there. That private Facebook group is for the supporting listeners at supportinglisteners.com. But we're starting a second private Facebook group because somebody had this brilliant idea. It's already been started. They just took it into their own hands and did it. I love that. And it's TWS bloggers, Tom Woods Show bloggers. And the idea is that this will be a private Facebook group for everybody who has started a site or a blog through my link. And it will be like a mutual help Facebook group. You know, maybe you're having a tech problem or a design issue. How do I make my site look better? Or what, you know, is there anything I can do to make my content better? Or what should I post? Or all these sorts of things you guys can brainstorm together. And the only requirement for membership is that you use my link to get your hosting for your site. And then if you want to be admitted into that group, instead of, I think it would be hard to go back and find everybody. So I'm appealing to you now. If now or in the future, in the past or whatever, you have gotten a site through my link, and you want to be admitted to this private group, then write to me at tomwoods.com, use the contact button, just tell me who you are, what your site is, and I'll give you the instructions to go ahead and get admitted to that group. So it's a private group, but I think it'll be really helpful. And so when somebody recommended it, everybody else said, yeah, that's a great idea. So I now have two private Facebook groups, a supporters group, but also for all you bloggers out there, it's like a mutual help group, and I think it'll do a lot of good, and we'll get some good synergy going in there. So if you'd like to be part of that group, and you've already done this in the past, and you know maybe I mentioned your site 200 episodes ago or something, just write to me and let me know, and I'll get you into that group. Meanwhile, I'm adding membership in this group as one of the perks that I'm listing at tomwoods.com/publicity. So from now on, that will also be a bonus. If you'd like to join our special bloggers group, then that's one of your bonuses. So tomwoods.com/publicity is where you should go. And that's going to do it for this week. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.